KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I get asked, like, are there celebrities that you're afraid of making fun of, or are you afraid of burning bridges? And I always think of, like, I have to build bridges before I burn them, don't I? Like, no one knows who I am, so I may as well just say what I really think.
Julie Klausner's actually not unknown anymore, thanks to her Hulu comedy, Difficult People. But she still speaks her mind through her show and on Twitter. The writer and actor tells us how she went from a job recapping Real Housewives episodes online to starring in her own show. And she shares memories of working with the inimitable Joan Rivers. But first on the news banter, the TV industry reshuffles the deck. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So TV, the TV business, it has been under a lot of pressure from changing models, streaming, on-demand, delayed viewing. It has been very, very tough for the networks to come up with anything, the big broadcast networks, that works. And meanwhile, one of the solutions that they're pursuing is to try to at least own the shows that are on their networks and make money that way, as well as by airing hits and making money from ads. What's happened this past week is that NBC dismissed the head of its television production studio, and meanwhile, Sony also dismissed the head of its television production studio. Different reasons, but a lot of instability.
Yeah, let's talk about NBC, because I think that's an interesting business question. Bella Baharia, who had run the studio for about 5 years, you know, she was producing shows that were considered interesting shows, but very niche. You know, she sold the Kimmy Schmidt show to Netflix, and she had a couple of other shows elsewhere, not on NBC. But if you look at NBC's schedule, other than the Dick Wolf shows, the two biggest hits on NBC are The Blacklist and Blindspot, both of which come from outside third-party studios. And for a modern network, that cannot happen. NBC wants to own the hits that it has because of this long tail of value. If you have a hit on NBC that you own, you can sell it into syndication. You can sell it to a Netflix or Amazon. You can sell it overseas. And with the ratings on the NBC network, as all broadcast television has experienced, down significantly, you want to have the added value of ownership, and NBC's studio was just not giving it that value.
Yeah, and that's fatal. And meanwhile, over at Sony, it's kind of a different thing. I mean, Sony is in a worse situation in a way than whoever runs the NBC production studio, because they have no network. Sony can't own a network, a broadcast network. It's a foreign entity. It's a Japanese company. Nonetheless, Sony TV, the TV side, was more successful than the film side. The film side has had a lot of management troubles, and Sony, the TV side, came up with things like Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, The Goldbergs on ABC, and Shark Tank, and a bunch of stuff, which is hard to do because, as you just said, these networks are not keen to buy stuff that they don't own. They would lean on Sony to own a piece of this stuff. But still, Sony has kept itself in the game. But, you know, this Steve Mosco, who is a real industry figure, he'd been there for years, he got into a power struggle, I guess, with Michael Linton, who runs the whole thing. And this was exposed in the Sony hack, which is, like, you know, in these situations, a couple of years after the fact, kind of a gift that keeps on giving to us in journalism. You were able to mine this for a story in The Hollywood Reporter that really exposed some of these tensions that arose, in fact, partly because of the success of that TV unit.
Yeah, for years, Steve Mosco had felt underappreciated by Sony. You know, it's this big splashy film studio with stars flying all over the world, and all the attention goes into film. And meanwhile, this bread and butter television studio with shows like Wheel of Fortune, Jeopardy,
which are big cash cows and have been for years.
Yeah, it was generating well over half of the profits of Sony, especially as the film studio was struggling. But it wasn't getting the recognition that Steve Mosco felt that it should. And a lot of these emails that were revealed in the Sony hack showed just how upset he was with this. And ultimately, the relationship between Michael Linton, the CEO of Sony Pictures, and Steve Mosco just wasn't tenable. So Steve Mosco is out, and they've elevated a duo that was running the studio from a much more creative standpoint to now run Sony Television.
Yeah, the one quick story that I love about Steve Mosco is we once at The Hollywood Reporter had a promotion where we sent out dog biscuits with the magazine, and he told me in a very funny way how he accidentally ate one because he didn't realize it was for dogs. So he had a good sense of humor, and now he's going to need a new job. Let me turn to box office this summer. Sequels are not doing so great. You know, we've had a pretty steady diet, but so far, Neighbors 2 didn't perform so strongly. Alice, you can argue whether Johnny Depp's legal problems with the allegations that he abused his wife hurt it. I think probably not. I think this has more to do with the film and maybe with where Johnny Depp is in his career. But it's got to be making the studios a little queasy, especially, you know, Disney's used to a lot of success, and this one was an expensive movie.
Yeah, and you saw it this weekend with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles sequel, which underperformed the original reboot from a few years ago. And that's become a trend over the past few months, is these sequels, which typically you do a sequel to outperform the original because there is pent-up demand and fan base that really wants to go see the sequel. And what you're seeing this past few months is they're underperforming the originals, which is very troubling to a lot of studios, because the entire model in the film business right now is to create franchise, franchise, franchise. If something is a hit or something fans respond to, do another one, and then do another one after that, and then spin it off into a cinematic universe. And, you know, with the exception of the big, powerful franchises like, you know, Captain America with Marvel, these kind of mid-range sequels that maybe arguably shouldn't have been made in the first place are not doing as well.
I can just imagine the listeners saying, well, they are not very good, so why would people go? And, you know, you just see that the studios are at a point where they're looking for anything familiar. I mean, we had a story this week about Sony wanting to do the Emoji movie, and then this German guy, this former video game exec, had trademarked all these emoji that he had designed and claimed that he has the rights to make the Emoji movie. But what struck me, which was not in our story about this, but I found out after the fact, is that not only was Sony pursuing this Emoji movie, but Fox had been pursuing an Emoji movie, which it dropped when Sony got involved, because they think that Emoji can turn into this some kind of thing that's recognizable that people will want to go see.
It's hard to tell these days sometimes between a Hollywood Reporter headline and an Onion headline when it comes to some of these movies that are in development. I mean, you saw a Tetris movie. I mean, Angry Birds, I think, is a perfect example of a movie that people were like, what? That's a game about birds that you fling across, but they found a way to make that into a movie. And it's all about this pre-branded intellectual property that the audience is already familiar with. And once you have a hit, you try to replicate it. And what's troubling to a lot of people is if the sequel business is not going to be that lucrative, then you've got to really rethink this whole franchise model.
And where will they go from there? Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. In the Hulu series Difficult People, Julie Klausner and Billy Eichner play Julie Kessler and Billy Epstein, best friends and struggling, snarky New York comedians with a tendency to blurt out whatever they're thinking. In the pilot episode, they chatter away in a child-filled Broadway theater before a matinee of Annie.
Oh, Annie is an understudy today, and her name is Taylor This Generation.
I swear to God, if she blows this role, I will strap down my and get up on that stage.
Excuse me, could you please watch your language?
Oh, my God, I am so sorry. Miss.
Yes.
Miss, I am so sorry. Okay. We can't do that at all.
You can't do that.
Not going to do that.
I'm sorry, I think you can.
We're seeing Annie. I paid $120. I can say if I want to.
When Klausner created Difficult People, she invented a character that is a version of herself. And she could certainly draw on her experience as a comedian in New York. She started out taking classes offered by the Upright Citizens Brigade in the late 90s, just as key members of the improv troupe, including Amy Poehler, moved from Chicago to Manhattan. Poehler is now executive producer of Klausner's show. Klausner has done all kinds of comedic writing, books, television, and recaps of Bravo reality shows for Vulture.
The "you've tried a lot of things" comment is something I'm used to hearing because I did try a lot of things until something, I don't even want to say worked as much as stuck. And I knew that I wanted to write and perform, and I loved TV, but it took a while and a lot of trying a lot of different things to get me to, you know, where I am right now with the show.
Yes, which is, you have a second season coming out. That's good, right? Second season.
Yes, yeah. I'm in the process of editing it right now, and I don't wish the experience of watching your face over and over again on my worst enemy, 7 hours a day in a dark room.
You don't get inured to it after a while? You don't just go, yeah, okay, I'm over it. I'm detaching. I'm going to do this without judging every minute. No.
People say detaching, and I want to know if there's like a how-to manual I can get for that besides drugs and alcohol, because I would love to be able to say, oh, that redheaded actress is doing something interesting instead
she's
of,
so funny.
Why is my chin that way?
Yeah.
Or it's really like the experience of being in a casino in the sense that there's no clocks or daylight, but instead of like three cherries for a jackpot, like two of them are your face looking bad. And then one of them is your face looking okay, but you get the, you know, the performance is bad.
So you did a lot of things, and among them you were doing recaps, which is what your character does on the show. And that was like early days for that sort of thing, right? I mean, it seems like you were very early into podcasting, very early into recapping, unless I am late to recapping and I just think you were early.
The big reason why my character is a recapper is that that was what I was doing when I wrote the script. I was writing for Vulture and doing videos for them, and that was sort of my main gig. But I think the explosion of recapping has something to do with the reality television explosion sort of after 2000. And recapping, you know, you can recap a fictional scripted show as well, but there's something about, especially the Bravo shows, that lend themselves to a sort of water cooler talking about what we just saw, sort of gossipy tone that is very comfortable in recapping. And that was a natural fit for me, as I was just typing things that I would have said to my friends at the time when we watched, you know, our Real Housewives soaps.
Let's talk about the evolution of your show. Did you shop it all over the place?
Yes. The timeline of events was, I wrote what essentially is the pilot, or became the pilot, on my own as a spec script, just thinking to myself, what would be the show that I'd want to do more than anything? And I wanted to do something based on my life, and I wanted Billy to play my best friend. And I was happy with the script, and I sent it to Amy. She was the first person I sent it to.
And, of course, you met Amy Poehler through Upright Citizens Brigade.
Yes, and that's how I know Amy. But, you know, we went through all the appropriate venues. I didn't text her, like, what's up, and, you know, attach a PDF. I submitted it through my agent to her agent, and then, you know, four or five of her lawyers. There's a whole telephone system that gets
well,
things
let me pause
to people
there
that
for
you know.
A second, because that's interesting. You know, if, I mean, I don't know how friendly would you, were you acquaintances, friendly acquaintances, because is there a form that should be observed in this kind of thing and you know what it is? Or, you know, I'm just wondering how that came to be.
Amy and I had always, she had always been so kind to me whenever I performed at the theater or saw her around the theater. She was always so warm and knew me, and, you know, we had close friends in common. Our friend Jamie Denbow is a close friend of both of ours, and she had been a guest on my podcast at the time, and we were friendly and we'd email, but this was my kind of like let's work together
your
moment.
Opening I, bid I, there kind of, yeah
yeah yeah absolutely and I you know took that chance, and she liked the script, and Amy was very instrumental in making the script a show. Amy came up with the title. Amy loves TV, knows a lot about TV, and sort of helped figure out what the mechanics of it would be going into a pitch. And then we went into the pitch, and Billy and I joked around and demonstrated our our lifelong and everlasting chemistry. And then USA decided, let's make a pilot or pilot presentation. And we made a pilot on pilot presentation money. And then when USA passed, I guess their scripted department had, at that point, Comedy Scripted was no longer, it had kind of dissolved. So at least we had this pilot to take around, and we took it all around. And Hulu loved it and wanted to work with us. And when we started working with Hulu, I hired a showrunner, Scott King, who is my co-writer and co-executive producer. And he and I, with very, very little time to write 8 episodes in order to get them shot in time for Billy to start production on Billy on the Street, wrote these 8 episodes, and in the process kind of, you know, trial and error and figured out, well, what is the show? Is it this, or what is our philosophy? You know, how are things going to come and you know, bite us in the ass later? Is it going to be, is it always going to be because we screwed up, or is it okay to have those consequences come down on them because the world around them is a crappy place? And is it a crappy place or a crazy place? And how much of this is grounded and how much of it is crazy? And just things that you have to try in order to see if they work. And also, you know, what are our victories and what is the dynamic between each character? And, you know, we figured out that Billy and Julie can never fight. You know, we don't want to ever have a fight on the show.
Because it's just too breaking of the relationship and the characters too.
You know, it's interesting. Like, I think the reason around that has to do with the nature of the medium of television and how beautifully it can demonstrate friendships to people. I think television is a better medium, and this is just something I'm saying as I'm thinking about it, so don't ask for too many, you know, too many proofs of this. But I was going to say that I think television is the best medium to demonstrate a romantic friendship, whereas I think of film as, you know, the love stories that they show in films, the romantic love stories between couples are way more poignant to me. The friendships that you see on TV are maybe because they take place over time, maybe because there's an intimacy to it being in your bedroom or your living room. But friends on TV is something that, when it works, really works. There's just a camaraderie and a comfort to watching friends get along that, you know, for some reason, watching them fight on TV is way more stressful than watching couples fight, I think.
Well, it's interesting, the question of the romantic friendship, because Billy is gay. And so many sitcoms or, you know, episodic comedies are driven by that sexual tension, you know, the Sam and Diane, which you guys just gave up at the gate. You know, there's no tension between you and Billy because you're interested in very different sorts of people. So
yeah, he's interested in men who go to the gym, and I'm interested in men who look like they might be dying of consumption. But yes, there's no sexual tension between me and Billy on the show. I'm going to say, going to go on the record and saying that it's a won't they or won't they situation. But I do think that one of my intentions, and I did go into this show with an agenda of my own sort of feminism and my own sort of ambition to represent gay men in ways that they truly are, and friendships in which they truly are. And I have very close friendships with gay men, and I think part of it has to do with the fact that there's no sexual tension, but I also think there's a part of it that has to do with gay men appreciating what's funny about women and listening to women or seeing things about women that straight men can, or other straight women can sometimes get complicated around recognizing. And I have just so much specific love for my gay friends that I wanted to depict that truthfully, and I wanted to show the intimacy of that. That's a big goal for me going into this, and one of the best compliments, you know, Billy ever gave me was, I think he said it at Paley, that this is a truthful depiction of what, you know, gay men's lives are like. It's not meant to be Will and Grace. You know, Billy is someone who, as a gay man, is never been the, oh my God, let's give you a makeover kind of sitcom stereotype, which is just so exhausting and offensive and just dumb. Like, the idea that there are gay men who only live to, you know, set you up on dates or do your hair. And it's like, what is this, the 1950s? Like, you know, we're self-contained human beings that love each other, and there are a lot of friendships like that.
Coming up after a short break, Julie Klausner tells us what she learned from her Twitter war with Zendaya. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer and actor Julie Klausner. Her series, Difficult People, starts its second season on Hulu on July 12th. Klausner is one of the difficult people in the show's title. The other is Billy Eichner, who plays her best friend. Part of their bond is they're both struggling with comedy careers that have failed to launch.
Oh, my God. I have to stop following Deadline on Twitter.
Why? What happened?
Remember that girl, Stephanie Goldstein, from our improv class?
Oh, the one that never heard of Monty Python?
Yeah. She just signed with CAA.
Shut up.
It was just announced. When's it going to be our turn?
Everybody we came up with in comedy has either quit to start a family or gone on to great success in film and television.
Klausner and Eichner are good friends in real life, but before they met, Klausner was already a fan of Eichner's YouTube videos, which were the basis for the Funny or Die show, Billy on the Street.
I had emailed him a fan letter, and he said he'd known my stuff as well, and we decided to get together over coffee and, we have to collaborate. We have to figure out a show that we're going to do together. And so Billy and I never really figured out what show we were going to do together. And then Billy on the Street became a show, and he hired me as a writer. And then we really got to know each other over the course of working together.
So it was clear that Billy would act in the show but not be a writer on the show. Or does he – do you improvise? I don't know if he contributes that way or if he basically has, his other stuff that he's doing and he can perform but can't really collaborate as far as the material.
Yeah, Billy's an actor on the show, but he is certainly encouraged to improvise. He's absolutely brilliant, and I'd be a fool if I didn't let him come up with his own stuff on the spot, or if he says, can I have some alts for this joke? We'll write him alts. He's an actor and a creative collaborator, but I like to have a script that we are very strict about getting all the dialogue that has been written for the show before we start goofing around. We also just don't have time to goof around. But I'm a little precious about my writing, to be honest. So I like to make sure people read the things.
So you could actually have a fight off camera as opposed to on camera. No fights on camera.
I've been very fortunate. Scott probably shelters me from a lot of stuff I don't know about. But people are generally really happy to do it. And if there's something that doesn't work, we always talk about it until it does. And It's a collaborative process. But there's a lot of thought that goes into those scripts before, I go off and write a draft. Scott and I have had hours and hours and hours of conversation about every detail.
And is Amy around, or did she say, sprinkle the holy water? And
Amy is very involved in every stage of the process, whether it's from pitching stories for an episode that we're not sure about, or else we have an idea and we type it up as an outline and send it to her. She gives notes on outline. She gets notes on first drafts. She sees every cut before it goes to Hulu. She's a very involved producer creatively.
So in the past, you worked for Mulaney, I guess, which was a short-lived show on Fox. But for Difficult People, did it make you more or less network-averse, classic network?
I always like to say that it's a good idea to write whatever you want, and then the person who wants it is your person. I try not to think about I'm going to write something for Showtime or I'm going to write something for NBC, because whenever you do that, they never buy it anyway. You may as well write something that you really want to write and see, who's in a position to let you do it. And I was open to that being NBC, Hulu. Honestly, it's just one of those things where you have to take a leap of faith and hope that there are people out there that wherever they work are going to like what you're doing and give you a chance to do it.
Yeah, Hulu was, it's pretty new to original programming. So I suppose that has its pluses.
Oh, no question.
Tell me what they are.
I was very lucky to work with Hulu before they really were completely established as a network because we were figuring out what we were doing and they were figuring out who they were. And there's a lot of freedom to that. There's a lot of experimentation that is present in those circumstances. And there's stuff that we'd get away with that we had no idea I was going to be able to get away with. I didn't know if we were going to be able to swear or explore certain topics or make certain jokes, but turns out we are. And it's just the best. I'm waiting for it to all cave in.
But you have quite a great array of people coming in through the door. You know, I guess friends you guys know through comedy, right? Kate McKinnon, Fred Armisen, Seth Meyers, all these people up here in the show. It's like a fun surprise to see who's going to pop up in what role.
I'm very excited about our guest stars. And even more so in season two, there are people you would never expect to see doing a comedy show. I mean, we had a call sheet where we had two Real Housewives and Lin-Manuel Miranda. They were all coming on the same day. And I was like, I love my show. I love my show so much. It was like, yep, that's Thursday. So
do
it's
you do
the best.
That on purpose? Do you think, like, what would be
no.
weird?
It was. I mean, I will say that, like, when we are writing, there is a, you know, delight to the absurdity of celebrity and the absurdity of celebrity with a, you know, juxtaposition, whether it's with another person or in a crazy situation. You know, we wouldn't be doing this if we didn't love celebrities. I mean, I get asked, like, are there celebrities that you're afraid of making fun of, or are you afraid of burning bridges? And I always think of, like, I have to build bridges before I burn them, don't I? Like, no one knows who I am. So I may as well just say what I really think about Tom Cruise or whoever and sort of reap the consequences later.
Some are less likely to be on the show than others, maybe. I don't know.
And I'm completely comfortable with that. And you know what? I did not go into this show hoping that everybody likes me. I'll tell you that. I'm always surprised that anybody likes me. So, you know, it can only be a pleasant surprise.
You know, you wrote for Joan Rivers. Speaking of not everybody is going to like you. What was it like writing for Joan Rivers?
Fabulous. It's like, it was fabulous. When I first met her, obviously, you're intimidated by the fact that she's a huge star. But at the same time, I felt like she was like a Jewish aunt.
Did she influence the way you write?
She influences the way I think about people reacting to what I write. She really had a tremendous amount of resilience and perspective and never expected everybody to love her and was just happy to be alive and working and moving forward and performing because she really loved it. And you know, F them if they can't take a joke. Like, that's an attitude that I have to remember when, you know, I like going there. But like my character, I could be very sensitive about the way people respond. But I look to her in a lot of ways for inspiration in that. And, you know, I think that she was a remarkably strong person and had a remarkably strong sense of self to be able to put herself out there the way she did over and over again.
Well, you had, not to stir a bad memory, or maybe it's a good memory, this thing with Zendaya in March where you tweeted, and it was not a joke. You were tweeting seriously about the body image issue.
Well, it was a joke. There were a couple jokes. And then I, you know, kind of made the mistake of like defending myself, which I don't think you should do with comedy. But yes, yes.
This social media space, this whole thing where you get this blowback of people riding down on you on the internet and suddenly you're in a fight and it's a thing. Maybe the takeaway is don't defend the joke. But does it make you think before you tweet more? Or is it that Joan Rivers thing about, you know what, this is what I think and you don't have to like me?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that context is essential. And I think that social media is very addictive in the sense of being able to feel like you've published
very quickly.
Yeah. My friend Tom Sharpling is off of Facebook, and he was talking to me like shortly after that whole thing went down, and he said, "Listen, when you tweet something and you get feedback from it, it's as though you did the work of writing a whole script and you heard back from someone saying they loved it. You get that feedback without having put in the work of actually producing something."
Wow.
And it feels like you did.
What an insight. Yeah.
And it's important to remember that you're chasing feedback. You're not sitting down and doing the work. So my attitude towards social media, since Difficult People became a reality, has really changed because, first of all, people listen to what I say, which I'm not used to. And then also, I have an amazing venue that I can use to express myself. It's called my TV show, and I need to make more use of that, I think, when I have something to say that maybe is not the most easily expressed or succinctly expressed in 140 characters.
Julie Klausner is the creator and star of Difficult People. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.